On this week's 51%, we bring you a few stories focused on women and the military, from U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand's calling out a report on sexual assaults.
I am tired of the statement I get over and over from the chain of command. We got this, ma'am. We got this. You don't have it. You're failing us.
To the Secretary of Veterans Affairs' take on the report, to the moving process. And in civilian life, we'll learn about axe throwing. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. The Department of Defense recently released a report showing that sexual assault in the military has increased. Democratic Senator from New York Kirsten Gillibrand spoke her mind during a Senate Armed Services Committee hearing in early May, addressing General James McConville, nominated to be Chief of Staff of the Army. She refers to SAPRO, which is the Sexual Assault Prevention and Response Office that conducts and reviews research to evaluate the effort and impact of sexual assault prevention and response programs across the Department of Defense.
We just got the SAPRO report for this year, and the results of sexual violence in the military ranks, unfortunately, continue to go up. We have a prevalence rate that went up by over 6,000 incidence rates. This is the Armed Services estimation of prevalence rate. We have data on numbers, and I have the data for the Army for you, so you can know.
She points to sexual assault prevalence rates for women by services in the Army having risen from 4.4% up to 5.8% in the 2018 survey.
So you're going in the wrong direction. Now, this is something that you must take responsibility for because it's an issue of climate. The Department of Defense also put together an analysis of risk patterns, as well as an analysis of the impact of climate on sexual assault, leading factors for DOD members. Okay, there's been an increase overall for a percentage of all members who experienced unhealthy climate. This is your job. This is chain of command's job. You set the tone. The people who report to you need to perform. If they don't, you need to dismiss them or make sure that they are punished appropriately. Right now, 24% of women say they're experiencing an unhealthy climate today. That's an increase. 6% of men are saying they experience an unhealthy climate. The odds of experiencing sexual assault when the climate is unhealthy for women, 1 in 5. For men, 1 in 12.
Gillibrand says sexual assaults occur mainly in the lower ranks.
And we have heard from survivors the reason they don't report as often as they could is because they don't believe the chain of command will have their back because their assailant is typically higher up in the chain of command. So they don't have the faith that the 06 and above, who are the convening authorities, will actually have their back.
She says the report shows there were an estimated 20,500 instances of sexual assault this fiscal year, an increase over the 14,900 estimated in the previous 2016 survey. The number of women in the military who experienced sexual assault increased by 50% from 8,600 in fiscal year 2016 to 13,000 in fiscal year 2018.
Do you know who's at the highest risk? Younger women, highly at risk. If you are 17 to 20 years old, the risk today, given the increase, the odds of experiencing sexual assault is 1 in 8. 1 in 8. If you're 21 to 24 years old, 1 in 11. 36 plus for the oldest, more senior women, still 1 in 56. So we have a huge problem on our hands. Now, what angers me the most, General, is that for the last 25 years, every Secretary of Defense has told this body, told the American public, we have zero tolerance for sexual assault. I have been working with my colleagues for the past 5 years to change how we treat these crimes, to professionalize it, to make sure we have more senior prosecutors who have more experience in prosecuting the case. Well, the most disturbing fact that I've just received is the percentage of cases that are moving forward by 06 or above decision-making is going down. Equally as disturbing, the percentage of cases that are ending in conviction are going down. I am tired of excuses. I am tired of statements from commanders that say zero tolerance. I am tired of the statement I get over and over from the chain of command. We got this, ma'am. We got this. You don't have it. You're failing us. The trajectories of every measurable are now going in the wrong direction. To have an increase, to have an estimated 20,000 cases. The statistics I'm looking at are as bad as they were when I started advocating for reforms. It is unconscionable. Past year prevalence of sexual assault for women in the military, 6.2%. 6 years ago, when we started to raise this issue for you to begin to address it, it was 6.1%. We have to do better. And I expect you to show strong leadership on this. It is your responsibility to make sure the men and women who serve, who will sacrifice their lives for this country, are protected. Their assailants are typically within the service. I find this to be your responsibility, General. Will you take this as seriously as if you would, as if it was your daughter in that 17 to 20-year-old service member list? Will you take this as seriously if it was her?
Yes, Senator.
Thank you.
Again, U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand speaking during a Senate Armed Services Committee hearing. The Democrat is running for president in 2020 in a crowded primary field. Meantime, Air Force Reserve Colonel Robert Wilkie, who has served as the U.S. Secretary of Veterans Affairs since July 2018, addresses the report, speaking with 51%'s Jim Lavoulis.
Secretary, the Pentagon this month released a report on sexual assault in the military. The anonymous survey showed assaults increased in all services and was the highest in the Marine Corps. It found that about one quarter of all women across the military experience sexual harassment. Is the VA system prepared to handle the possible mental health care or other health care needs that could arise from such assaults?
We certainly do. We screen everyone who comes to VA, not only for mental health issues, but for military sexual trauma. That is part of the new way of looking at these things. We've also, when it comes to claims Americans have made on VA, when it comes to the issue of military sexual trauma, we have reopened cases that were closed, I think going all the way back 5 years. I think that's right. So that we review each of these cases in light of the new emphasis placed on combating this terrible conduct. So we are aware, and I think we've made some incredible strides. But to give you an example of what has happened, and this happens to men and women as well. It's not confined to women, although it is predominantly women. The very face of our VA has changed. When my father was commissioned 2 months before Kennedy was inaugurated, less than 0.5% of the active force was women. When I stepped down as the Undersecretary of Defense last year, more than 17% of the active duty force was women. What's that? What does that mean for VA? It means 10% of those we see are women, and we've had to change the way of doing business. We've had to emphasize women's health and family health in ways that we've never done before.
That was U.S. Secretary of Veterans Affairs Colonel Robert Wilkie, speaking with 51%'s Jim Lavoulis. There is proposed bipartisan legislation in the House to direct the Secretary of Veterans Affairs to submit a report to Congress on the availability of prosthetics for women veterans. Republican New York Congresswoman Elise Stefanik is co-leading the legislation with Democrat Chris Pappas of New Hampshire. Stefanik says the VA has a long history of developing and providing state-of-the-art prosthetic technology and rehabilitation services for veterans with amputations. However, the research is largely focused on developing prosthetics for men and has failed to take into account the difference in women's body types during the creation of this technology. The legislation is supported by multiple veteran service organizations, including the Disabled American Veterans Department of New York. After years of complaints, the Pentagon is trying to reform the way it manages the moving process for military families. The current system is plagued by delays, lost shipments, theft, and a lack of accountability, as Carson Frame reports for the American Homefront Project.
Hey, Leah, do you want to come read a book?
Andrea Cacho and her family are finally settling into their new home at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, after a difficult move last summer. The Army transferred Cacho's husband from a base in Kentucky and paid to move all of the family's possessions to their new home. But things got off to a rocky start. Cacho says the company assigned to pack the household showed up late and did a careless job.
The corners of the boxes were, like, bulging. My husband's a medic, so we only had medical tape in the house, but I put medical tape on top of their packing tape because it was just not sticking to the boxes.
After the shipment left Kentucky, it took months for it to get to the Cachos in Virginia, a trip that normally takes about 10 hours. The items changed hands repeatedly, with four companies responsible for packing, trucking, and warehousing them. By the time they arrived, they'd been damaged to the tune of about $4,000.
Every box was smashed. There was water damage. There was mold. Like our wedding photo, our TV, everything was shattered.
Military families have long complained about the poor quality of their moves. Last August, one spouse circulated a Change.org petition pushing Congress to hold moving companies accountable. It went viral, gathering more than 100,000 signatures. That forced the military to rethink its approach. General Stephen Lyons heads U.S. Transportation Command, or TRANSCOM, the part of the Defense Department responsible for household moves. He says there are too many offices involved, and that makes it hard for the military to manage movers. And there's little quality control to make sure companies with spotty records don't keep getting work.
Today, if you were to look at the way we manage this program in the department, completely diffused, completely decentralized, every service is running their own thing, there's no enterprise approach. A carrier can be suspended over here, working over here.
Now TRANSCOM wants to hire what it calls a single move manager by the summer of 2021. It's a private company that would build networks within the moving industry and oversee contracting. The Canadian and UK militaries already use programs like it. Rear Admiral Pete Clark of TRANSCOM says the current system is so complex and overregulated that movers often don't want to take part. He says that's why there's a shortage of quality movers during peak seasons.
The primary premise is that the single move manager, who will be an industry expert, will remove the barriers for entry that the government has put in place.
But the change worries some advocates. Kelly Ruska of the National Military Family Association says she's not sure which problem TRANSCOM is trying to solve.
The most common complaint that we're hearing is a quality issue. Too few transportation providers, a lot of broken items, and that the claims process is overly burdensome. So I'm not exactly sure how outsourcing the management is going to solve all of the other problems.
Ruska says military families weren't adequately consulted about the changes, and they're concerned that the military has so few specifics about a program that's supposed to start soon. Andrea Cacho says the stakes are high for fixing the problem, because bad moves are more than just an inconvenience. They're affecting the military's mission.
I know personally multiple people that were like, okay, we're just going to get out of the military after this term because of the move. So then you're losing your soldiers.
The single move manager system is still in its infancy. In June, the Defense Department plans to get bids for moving and logistics companies. The military still needs to work out a lot of details, but expects the system will do a better job getting service members' possessions to their new homes safely. This is Carson Frame reporting.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. In the last 10 years, axe throwing has become an international phenomenon, building a worldwide community of passionate axe throwers and a number of axe throwing venues. Most people discover axe throwing through a trip to a venue for, say, a birthday celebration or a Friday night work social. For them, axe throwing goes from a fun night out to a weekly staple. They join axe throwing leagues and could discover not just their new favorite sport, but their tribe. Like-minded, friendly people who love throwing axes and making friends. And it's not just local leagues that offer competitive axe throwing these days. There are national and international axe throwing competitions that are becoming serious business. 30-year-old Krista Mackey began her axe-throwing journey a little over a year ago in Whistler, Canada. She has gone on to compete at the annual National Axe-Throwing Championships in Toronto, where there's a $20,000 prize pot. Mackey tells 51%'s Elizabeth Hill that it was actually her boyfriend's joke that helped get her into the sport.
We had gone to the shooting range north of where we live in Pemberton just to give it a try, and I think I scared him a little bit with my accuracy. So when the job posting came up for an axe throwing host, he looked at me and was like, "You're already in charge of security when the zombies come, so you may as well go round out your skill set." And it was honestly more of a joke than anything. I'd never thrown axes before. I'm not particularly sporty. So yeah, the first time I'd ever thrown a hatchet was when I came in for my job interview.
What does being an axe throwing host entail?
So we greet guests coming in, and you're kind of reading the room a little bit. Some people come super pumped up. Some people come in extremely nervous. Some people come in being convinced by a friend or a partner or a workmate or whatever it might be, and they're not really sure what they're getting into. So our first interaction with them is to make everybody feel super safe and welcome in the space, let them know that there's not anything to worry about. It's like playing darts, like you're handling a sharp object, but you're not going to like intentionally go out of your way to injure yourself or anyone else with that sharp object. The intro of our session is always like a pretty good overarching safety chat. And then, we lead the guests through their very first throws. They're with us. So there'd be like four guests on the lanes to one host. So we've got a really good teaching ratio. And then we show them the basics of throwing with two hands, let them get kind of a grasp for that, work on them with that a little bit, working on their distance and different points of their throw. And then we let them try out throwing with one hand. And then before anybody gets too comfortable or starts thinking that anybody in the group is like the number one star and like they're not so great at this, we start playing games together. So it takes the pressure off. You don't feel like it's just your throws counting in the game. It's more of like a team environment. So we find that always brings the best out of people. Maybe if they weren't the best thrower individually, they're really loving being part of a team and playing the game. And then depending on how the group is feeling and the skill level and different kind of like age levels that we have present, we'll work on trick shots with them, show them some different ways of throwing the axe, maybe even get them throwing two axes at the same time, which is always a favorite. We call it like graduating at the end, where we let them throw like a full size axe at the end and give that a couple goes. And normally that's like the icing on the cake for a lot of people.
And why do you think it's gaining such popularity?
We thought it was pretty fitting for us being up in Whistler. We're tucked at the bottom of the mountain, really get that like Canadiana experience, I guess, is kind of the way we get the international guests to come about to it. But it's taken off like in urban centers more than anywhere else, which I thought was crazy at first. But you think about it like it's a leisure sport, right? People are looking for those activities like bowling or like darts that don't necessarily require you to be this outstanding athlete, be particularly fit. It's all about like focus and determination and practicing. And I think it's that inclusivity that has made it take off so much. We let kids as young as 10 come in. I've taught people on the cusp of turning 90 how to throw axes before. All genders, all physical abilities, all mental abilities. So I think that that's the biggest draw, that it really doesn't exclude too many people from being able to participate. And once you come in for a session, you kind of get that taste of it. You find out that there's an axe throwing league. You're like, oh, these people get together like once a week to do that? Like, that's pretty interesting. I talk with people every single day. Like, I threw the best game of my life last night. I threw a super natural perfect game, which is the best that you could throw in an axe throwing match. I posted my accomplishments today, and I have people from all over North America in the axe throwing community sending me messages today just being like, good job, like, way to go, you got it so quick, or you've been working so hard, or whatever it is. So you kind of, I feel like you go at it in tiers. Like, you come to your first session, then maybe you come with a friend to a league night, then you join it, you see, like, it's not this macho, like, bravado-driven sport. Like, it is more of a community. You're cheering for the person that you're throwing against. Like, I'm offering bits of coaching to my opponents because I want them to be the strongest opponents that they can be and give me a run for my money, right?
Right. What type of mental and physical endurance do you have to maintain to compete on a national level?
once you get into competition, the rounds get a lot longer. So don't get me wrong. Like, at the end of a playoff night, you're not doing 3-round games anymore. You're into 7-round games. And every round that ties, you now need to throw a big axe to break that tie. So it does become physically wearing in those type of competitions. But in your weekly night of league, it's a mental game more than anything. And that was my biggest struggle when I went to Nationals, standing beside people and automatically writing myself off that they're going to be better than me when I don't know that. And realistically, like, there's nothing that they're doing that's going to affect my throw. It's me letting them into my own mind that's going to affect my throw. So really, like, getting that on board and even trying to, like, foster that in our league. Because I watch people and they'll come and they practice and they're doing great. And the second there's an opponent beside them and we're in a game setting and there might be a few extra people watching, that pressure that we heap on ourselves, that's what ruins you. It's not throwing a bullseye and, like, picking it up and throwing again. Like, that makes you stronger every single time. But that negative self-chat I found to be the hardest part to overcome in the year that I've been throwing. And I feel like I'm just kind of on that cusp now where I've got those voices a little more under control. And I'm kind of, like, cheerleading myself in my head now instead of beating myself down before I've even thrown the axe. It's been a journey on both sides, but as far as the physical bit, that's not too hard to overcome. I have a little bit of axe throwing juice, some coffee, and you're good to go. But yeah, the mental game is definitely the part that requires more training in my mind.
And at least at the national level, when you compete, there are no gender divides. You could go up against, you know, a 6'9" bearded man and be a 5'2", 120-pound woman like me.
That's pretty much exactly what happened my first round at Nationals.
Do you think that it's a fair competition?
Absolutely, I do, because I really don't think it matters the gender behind the arm that's throwing. Like, I'm not running full speed up to the board. I don't need that extra burst of power. In fact, as a coach, every single day in my sessions, I will preach finesse over force. Focus on your accuracy and the form of your throw and really calming down to be able to get there. If I boil my game down to that, then it really, there's no advantage or disadvantage. I might be at a slight disadvantage because I'm a little less experienced, and there's no novice category or beginner category or an expert category, but I love that. I love that I've had the privilege to throw against the top-ranked person in the National Axe Throwing Federation. I've got to throw with him at 2 different tournaments, and that's, like, a fantastic feeling to be like, I'm in the same room as these people. I'm on the same level as them, and they all consider you their peer. It's not like this 6-foot-tall bearded giant is going to come stand up beside me on the lanes and be like, oh, like, I've got this in the bag. Like, that's really not the vibe in our community, and that's another reason why I love it so much. I'm part of a group, our Facebook group and our Instagram handle is Women of Axe Throwing, and we're a group of women that actively support each other. We scour, like, the internet and social media to find other women throwers to support their accomplishments. We highlight people weekly. We have female coaches from all over North America explaining different trick shots, offering you pro tips, giving you a space for women that maybe don't feel like celebrating their accomplishments in the bigger mixed gender axe throwing groups, that will come to our group and be like, hey, I threw my first bullseye. And that's enough for, like, our group to be like, that is awesome. Like, that's your first step. This is what comes next. Keep practicing. You're doing great. Like, we celebrate everything. It doesn't matter how minor or major it might seem. And for me, like, coming into that community, I'm not one to really shout out my accomplishments. I'm more afraid of somebody being like, yeah, so. And I know other women feel that, like, yeah, it's an accomplishment for me, but in the grand scheme of things, maybe it doesn't mean so much to everybody else. And we're trying to break that down and be like, no, everything is worth celebrating. That's how you keep momentum. That's how you keep moving the goalposts forward. As long as you're constantly improving and pushing your own game, that's what we're all about. So,
and you've touched on this throughout the entire interview, but what do you think, at least personally, are the mental health benefits of axe throwing?
It forces you to be present, which I think is something that we are lacking nowadays. Like, we're constantly having our minds pulled in 1,000 different directions, whether it be a news story or getting email updates constantly on our phones or social media or things like that. And when you're on the lane for those 15 throws, it's you and the boards and the person you're against. You choose in that moment to let all the other noise in or stay in your zone, stay in that kind of zen state and keep going. I threw probably the worst game I've thrown, two games before the best game of my life. And I was going through that game, beating myself up, and to be able to like take a break between games and be like, okay, that throw has no bearing on any other throws that I'm going to throw unless I give it that power, which sounds so hokey to make it this like mental exercise, because people come in, they're like a bunch of barbarians, like throwing bits of metal at the wall. Like, but if you talk to people that have been throwing for a while, I feel like you'd find a consensus among most of us that it is the mental game. Like, it's a constant battle against yourself and against those self-deprecating remarks that we make to ourselves that will literally impair your physical ability. And I think having a sport that highlights that so obviously without any other distractions, it's you and the game. And it's forced me, like, over the past year to really work on it. And I find the strength that I've found through axe throwing and the focus and care that I give to the sport, I'm trying to take that outside of the lanes, too, and outside of the arena and carry that into the rest of my life, which is trickier because then you're back into the world with all those distractions.
That was Canadian axe thrower Krista Mackey speaking with 51%'s Elizabeth Hill. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Elizabeth Hill for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1557.